Chapter 16. Cadence and Cascade knelt before the remains of Hesperus. They were aboard my ship, in orbit around Naomi. They had been like that for at least 2 hours, side by side, with their silver and white hands touching him where his body emerged from the warped golden growth that had bonded him to the wreckage of his ship. The two living robots had been silent and still, with only the movements of the lights in their skulls, agitated and rhythmic, indicating the continuation of machine consciousness. As for Hesperus, there had been no visible change in his condition since I had last seen him. The lights in his head were dim and ember-like, their movements almost imperceptible. Cadence and Cascade's hands were not just touching him, but appeared to be pressing into his body, as if the gold armor of his skin was no more resilient than clay. But when they withdrew their hands, slowly and in unison, no impression remained. Cadence turned her lovely silver face to mine. "He is not dead, Perslane. Threatened with grave injury, he has consolidated his mental processes, whittling himself down to a tiny flickering candle of intelligence and memory. He can be saved, but there is nothing we can do for him here." "On Naomi?" I asked. "Nothing there either," Cadence said, his voice as soothing and reassuring as ever, even when he was imparting dismal news. "He must be returned to the machine people in the Monoceros ring. There he can be brought back to full functionality and rewarded for his efforts on our behalf." I thought of the tens of thousands of years that might pass before he reached machine space. As much time again might elapse before he returned to us, if that ever happened. Even for a Shatterling, used to thinking in terms of circuits, the weight of those years felt enormous, interminable. "Will he survive the journey?" "That would depend on the ship," Cadence said. "It would need to be a fast one, to minimize the subjective time interval. Since he cannot be placed in abeyance, he must endure every second of the voyage, as measured by ship clocks." "Can't we make a stasis cabinet large enough?" "Not with Naomi technology, and we lack the tools to manufacture one ourselves." "Can he be taken apart, broken into smaller pieces, if we can just get part of him into a cabinet?" "He would not survive dismantling," Cascade said. "Besides, his sentience is distributed throughout his body. No part of him could be safely discarded."
"You said he'd consolidated himself, shrunk his consciousness down," I said to Cadence.
"I was speaking metaphorically," she said. "The technicalities would not lie within your compass of understanding. Rest assured that transportation is his only chance."
"Will he survive a trip down to Naomi?"
"If he is handled gently," Cadence said.
"Then I'd still like to present him to the spirit, as we discussed before. It may not make any difference, but at least I'll have tried."
"We have no objections," said Cascade. "There are risks in transporting him to the surface, obviously, but there are also risks in returning him home as he is."
"You think he's going to die, whatever happens," I said.
"The possibility is always there," Cadence said, "but we shall not obstruct you in your wishes. Would you like to take him down to Naomi now?
We can assist with the operation." "I still haven't had the final say-so from the authorities."
"We will speak on your behalf if further persuasion is required," Cascade said. "If he communicated this wish to you, then we are also compelled to honor it."
"Let us move him now," said Cadence.
I stood back.
"If you think..."
"We shall treat him with kindness and care," Cascade told me. I watched as they moved to either side of Hesperus's misshapen bulk and took hold of his extremities. They lifted him without effort, smoothly and gracefully. I had been about to offer to turn off the gravity or bring a cargo handler, but the robots had no need of my assistance. They carried him through the ship and into the vast cavern of my main cargo bay, where I had docked the shuttle. Robots had asked me about the bay's contents when we arrived, amused by, or at least politely interested in, the number of ships I carried around with me, but now their attention was fixed on their patient, and they paid no heed to the ships. It was after sundown when we landed at Ymir, the cooling barkans singing into the night. I had the robots deliver Hesperus to a secure room in the tower where we were all being accommodated. It felt wrong to lock him away in there, stored like a piece of luggage,
but the room would notify me of any changes in his condition. Returning to my own quarters, I was surprised not to find Campion waiting for me. He wasn't in his own rooms either. I felt let down. I had seen the concern on his face when I left, or imagined I had seen it, so I had assumed he would be awaiting my return, to let me know he was glad to have me back. Feeling sullen and sorry for myself, and realizing that it was too late to join the other Shatterlings for the evening meal, I had the room prepare me food to Gentian standards. I ate it without enthusiasm, sitting on my bed with my shoes off, facing the open window to my balcony and watching the curtains stir in the warm breeze. Now and then a flying figure buzzed past, coloured wings glowing like stained glass windows in the sky. Most of these honey-coloured creatures would be dead before a single Gentian touched down on another world, but they did not appear to mind, nor did they seem any less contented than other galactic cultures. They flew as if they had been born to the air, and their wings were delightful. So what if they had seen nothing of the wider galaxy beyond what was shown to them by visiting travellers? So what if their civilization, according to the dour prognostications of the universal actuary, showed every indication of being ephemeral, doomed to become part of the endless, rolling despond of turnover within a circuit or two? The people of Naomi were thinking of today, not some century in the distant future. Perhaps the lines had it all wrong, I thought. We accumulated experience for the sake of it, stretched our lives out across millions of years, but even when things were going well, even when we were not being ambushed, pushed to the brink of extinction, there was a neurotic anxiety at the back of all our minds, a shrill voice instructing us to see everything, to look around every corner, to leave no stone unturned. We were like children who had to try every sweet in the shop, even if it made us sick. We knew there was more of the galaxy than we could ever encompass by ourselves, but the voice did not allow us to take that as license to give up. All it said was, try harder. And where had it taken us? 32 circuits of the galaxy, and I still did not feel as if I knew anything more than when I had first stepped out of the vat, naked as a new mole rat, ravenous with Abigail's insane craving to gorge herself on reality. People lived and died and did strange, pointless things to themselves. So did societies, be they city-sized states or galactic empires encompassing thousands of solar systems. Everything came and went. Everything was new and bright with promise once, and old and worn out later, and everything left a small diminishing stain on eternity, a mark that time would eventually erase. "You're back," Campion said, standing at my door. He had entered silently, his footsteps disguised by the swish of the curtains, and a squall of brassy Emirian music from one of the adjoining towers. It was the end of the working week, and the locals were partying before going home. "Yes," I said, turning around, my expression blank. "I was with Mazerion," he said, tapping his chronometer. "We dialed for 6 hours. It went by in a flash, just a few minutes of subjective time. It wasn't until I came out that I realized how late it was. I'm really sorry. I wanted to be here when you came back down." I felt so miserable, so dejected, that I was ready to forgive him anything. All I wanted was a hint that he had meant to be there. I could not blame him for losing track of time under the influence of Mesh. It had happened to all of us. "I missed you," I said. "Things didn't go too well." "I'm sorry." Campion walked into the room, leaned over the bed and kissed me. "Tell me what happened, assuming you want to talk about it." "Nothing, really. They touched him for a long time and then said there wasn't anything they could do. He isn't dead, but they can't help him. They could if they took him back to the other machine people, but there's no guarantee he'd survive the journey."
"Where is he now?"
"Here, in another room. They let me bring him down."
"Did you hear anything about the spirit?"
"Nothing."
"There's still time. If we don't get anywhere by tomorrow morning, we'll schedule another meeting with the magistrate. She'll come round in the end. Everyone does, eventually."
I did not feel his optimism, but I was too weary and deflated to argue the point. Campion had the maker prepare 2 glasses of cold white wine. Rather than bringing mine to the bed, he walked out onto the balcony, the glasses chinking in his hand. I stirred gloomily and followed him, leaving my shoes by the bed. The music rose and fell in surging seasick waves, as if it was playing at the wrong speed. "Tell me what happened with Mazarian," I said. He told me everything about the afternoon.
"We know more than we did this morning. He's Thorn, a Melictor Shatterling. He also knows more than he's telling us about the House of Suns."
"Whose idea was it to ask him about that?"
"Just a hunch."
I took my glass from his hand. "A good one."
"We still don't know what it is. A hidden line, maybe. Something the commonality doesn't even know about. And how do the Marcellins and Melictons fit into it?"
"Or the Gentians. We're involved as well."
"Because they ambushed us?"
"Because the ambush required line infiltration. We worked that one out already. Nobody could have got those H-guns close to the planet otherwise."
"I'm trying not to think about that," Campion said. "It's bad enough knowing there might be another line out there that wants us dead without thinking about snakes in the grass."
"It could even be one of us."
"You and me?"
"I mean one of the survivors, one of the Gentians who made it to Naomi. If someone knew about the ambush, it wouldn't have been difficult to hide during the attack, and then make it look as if you'd only just survived. How do we know the snake isn't sitting down to breakfast with us, working out how to finish the rest of us off? Some of us have been acting a little oddly."
"You mean like Bettany?" Campion asked, oblivious to the possibility that someone might be spying on us. "No, it won't be him. He's just seen his chance for scoring a few points at our expense, that's all. It'll be someone keeping a low profile, someone we haven't even begun to suspect."
"Or no one," I added. "There might not be a snake, after all."
"No, there might not be. But until we know otherwise, I think we ought to assume the worst. We were getting complacent. That's why someone was almost able to wipe us out. Those ships should have been inspected for concealed weapons before they got within attack range of the Reunion world."
"Should-haves don't count. And can you imagine how long that would take? Longer than the Reunion itself? Just think of the time it would take to search through Silverwing's hold. And I'm not the worst hoarder by a long way." I shook my head. "No recriminations, no going over old ground. The way we did things worked fine for 32 circuits. There can't have been too much wrong with it."
After a silence, Campion said, "You know what I keep coming back to. We'd never have visited this world unless something bad had happened to us. Never have heard those singing sands, seen this beautiful city. We might have traveled here eventually, I know, but it wouldn't be Naomi the way it is now. We'd probably be seeing it half a dozen civilizations down the line, when the Emirians will just be a memory."
I drank the wine, wanting it to go to my head as quickly as possible. "If you're trying to see good in this, I'm not sure I'm quite ready to make that leap."
"I'm just saying, it's a strange universe. It can still surprise us. That's why it's worth carrying on, I suppose. If I felt that all we were doing was reliving a fixed set of experiences in different permutations..."
"That wouldn't be so bad, if those experiences were pleasant ones. Do you ever get tired of sunsets?"
"No," Campion said. "Do you ever get tired of waterfalls or beaches?"
"No." "Then there's always hope for us."
A chime sounded behind me. I handed Campion my glass and returned to the room, leaving him alone on the balcony. When I settled myself before the console, I was confronted with the waiting face of Magistrate Jindabyne.
"I wasn't expecting to hear from you now," I said.
"Did I not promise that I would be in touch?" she asked, not bothering to hide her indignation.
"It's just that it's getting late."
"But it isn't midnight yet. I promised you I would give you a decision by the end of today.
It just took a little longer than anticipated to make the necessary arrangements.
Have you changed your mind concerning the spirit of the air?"
"I'm even more convinced now that it's the only way I can possibly help Hesperus."
The magistrate narrowed her sharp, intelligent eyes. "Tomorrow afternoon, at precisely 3 o'clock, a flyer will arrive for you at the 18th level landing deck. Aboard it will be a member of the Scientific Study Council, an expert on the spirit of the air. Provided conditions remain favorable, he will arrange for you to be taken to the observation platform, where you may anticipate an encounter with the spirit." I was aware of Campion standing behind me.
"Thank you, Magistrate," I said. "It's kind of you to allow this."
"Not kind. Foolish, perhaps.
Perhaps. I should have known something was coming, but it was only when the next morning's breakfast was winding down that I realized what Bettany had been planning. Just before we would have begun to leave the table, Cadence and Cascade appeared on the balcony, and Bettany introduced them with a magicianly flourish of his napkin. The robot's imperturbable expressions gave no hint that they knew what was about to unfold. "Since we're all here," Bettany said, looking around the table as if to make sure no one had already left, "this is as good a time as any to settle a small matter that has come to our attention. Our two guests from the machine people had the unpleasant misfortune to become embroiled in Gentian affairs when they were caught in our ambush. Luckily, they were unharmed, and even more luckily, they appear to hold nothing against us for failing to keep them out of our troubles." "You could hardly have anticipated the ambush," Cadence said. "I suppose that's true, but you still have every right to feel aggrieved," Bettany answered. Cascade said, "You protected us as best you could, and then gave us passage to this world. We have no argument with Gentian line, or by implication the commonality. But it cannot be ignored that a crime has been committed, one that now encompasses the machine people." "We must convey news of this atrocity back to the Monoceros Ring," Caden said. "The machine people will weigh the evidence and decide upon an appropriate response. The Shatterlings of Gentian line may rest assured that we will support them unconditionally, should punitive action be required. We hope that the perpetrator is no more than a rival line, encompassing a few hundred or a few thousand individuals. But we will not quail, even if it turns out that another civilization is responsible." "We couldn't ask for wiser or stronger allies," Bettany said. "That's why we'll do everything we can to assist your return to your own people." I tensed as it began to dawn on me where this was heading. "Unfortunately, we have no means of transport," Cascade said. "We could, of course, simply transmit the intelligence back to our people, but then we would be at the mercy of human networks until the signal escapes the main disk. It might be corrupted or fail to reach its target. If we convey it in person, we will know that the information has reached home intact. We will also be able to ensure that it is acted upon with the necessary swiftness." "There is also the business of Hesperus," Cadence said, turning her silver head until her eyes met mine. "Short of a miracle on Naume, his only chance for survival now rests in a safe return home, in the fastest possible vehicle." "You want my ship?" I said in a half whisper. Cadence nodded. "We have studied the specifications of all the craft in orbit around Naume. All are fast, but yours will be able to accelerate closer to the speed of light than any other ship available. Silver Wings of Morning also has the best chance of surviving what will be a protracted voyage, even by line standards. It will not be possible to slow for repairs or augmentations." "They've looked into it, crunched the numbers," Bettany said, giving me a sympathetic look, as if none of this was his doing. "Your ship is the one most likely to get them home, and do it before anything untoward happens to Hesperus." "Your ship is fast," I said. "It accelerates harder, but Adonis Blue doesn't have your cruise ceiling, and that's what really matters." "We will do all in our power to return your ship," Cascade said. "You need only consider it borrowed, not given away." "So I'll get her back in 1,000,000 years or so." "You have owned the ship for much longer than 1,000,000 years, so even an interval of that enormity would not appear unreasonable." "This is very good, Bettany," I said, turning away from the robots. He looked intrigued. "In what sense?" "You found a way to screw me without looking as if you're screwing me. This is the punishment, isn't it? For Campion and me, for what we did. The consorting, the being late. Never mind that we brought the Line 5 survivors it wouldn't have had otherwise. Never mind the prisoner or Hesperus. We've still got to pay, even if it's done sneakily, without looking like official censure." "Not in front of our guests, Perslane, please. We're asking you to make a benevolent gesture, not to suffer a punishment." I knew with crushing certainty that I could not win, that any attempt to argue my way out of this would not only be futile, but would cost me even more dearly in the future. "How do you want to do this?" I asked. "You can table a proposal, but you don't get to decide line policy all by yourself. The matter still needs to be voted on." Bettany nodded keenly, If you and Campion would like to leave us for a moment, we can vote. It needn't be unanimous. We're only deciding on a reallocation of property, not something as serious as excommunication. I looked around the room. There were one or two dozen shatterlings I felt certain I could count as allies, but that would not be enough to win the vote. Some of the others would undoubtedly align themselves with Bettany. I'll spare myself the humiliation, I said. You can have the ship. In which case we'll forget your earlier outburst. It's understandable that you'd feel a sense of attachment. I'm sure we can all empathize.
Thank you, Perslane, said Cadence and Cascade in unison. It is very generous of you. We shall take good care of the ship.
And me? I asked Bettany. What do I do without a ship? Do I stay here when everyone else agrees to leave Naomi?
You're amongst friends now, he said.
That's not how it feels.
You'll get over it.
She doesn't have to, Campion said, standing up from the table, crumbs flying from his lap. In fact, I'd be disappointed in her if she did. I hope you fuckers can live with yourselves after this. He glared angrily at the seated audience. I know not all of you would have gone against Perslane in a secret vote, but I didn't hear any of you speaking up to support her just now, not even you, Aconite, or you, Mazerion.
It's just a ship, Aconite said. No need to get so worked up about it, old man.
It's her ship. She's had it longer than most of you have had memories.
Then we'll pool our resources and get her a new one, Aconite said, glancing nervously to his left and right, as if measuring the support for this proposal.
I'll live, I said, although I was shivering with rage and indignation. Let them have her. If Bettany had had the good grace to ask me, instead of demanding it, I might just have given her away myself.
We are sorry to be the cause of unpleasantness, the robot said. I felt some of my irritation twist towards them, but I held it in check. It's not your fault. I'm not angry at you for wanting a fast ship. I know all you want to do is help Hesperus.
He means a great deal to us, Cadence said.
More than you can imagine, added Cascade.
The two of them were holding hands, chrome in ivory. Afterwards, at least a dozen shatterlings came up to me in ones and twos and expressed various degrees of sympathy and indignation. My first instinct was to scold them for not showing more support when it counted, but I succeeded in biting my tongue, reminding myself that to many of them I had actually got off lightly compared to the censure that, in theory at least, I might have been due.
"We don't agree," was a sentiment I heard more than once. "You deserved a rap on the knuckles, but nothing like this. All the same, if that's the worst Bettany does to you, you've come out of it rather well. It could have been much, much worse."
"Yes, and it could also have been a lot better," I said, resenting the implication that I deserved any punishment whatsoever. "He didn't have to censure me at all." They asked, "Do you think he's done now? Or will he go after Campion as well?"
"He's done. He knows that if he hurts me, he hurts Campion. He won't risk looking vindictive. He's too much of a politician for that."
There was talk of helping me get a new ship, questions about whether any of the vehicles in Silverwing's hold might serve for the time being, a general display of goodwill from my friends, and from one or two I had not counted as allies, but who were kind and sympathetic in unexpectedly touching ways. But it was clear to me that the vote would not have gone my way had I pressed for it. I was relieved in a dispirited sense. At least I had walked out of that room with my dignity intact. I could be forgiven my little outburst. I had only voiced what many of them were thinking, and even my enemies could not deny the cynical impulse behind my punishment. Even if I had not had the fastest, strongest ship in orbit, Bettany would have found a way of giving mine to the robots. Since there was no reason for Cadence and Cascade to remain on Naomi indefinitely, they certainly did not need to wait until the line made up its collective mind about where to go next. It was agreed that the handover of my ship would take place sooner rather than later. Silverwing's troves were nearly duplicated aboard Dalliance. The process of consolidating final backup required only hours of additional data transfer. The formal handover would involve me authorizing Silver Wings to accept Cadence and Cascade as her new masters, but that would involve only a simple statement being made in the ship's presence. Once that formality was complete, the ship would be theirs. But there remained the matter of Hesperus. It was agreed that the robots would not depart until I had brought him into the presence of the spirit of the air, whatever the outcome of that might be. If he was healed, they would leave with him or without him, according to his wishes. Otherwise, they would gather his remains, if any were left, and convey him back to their part of the galaxy. It was agreed that the robots would depart on a trajectory that would avoid any chance of detection by the ambushing elements, even if that added a few centuries to their journey time. Of course, once they left Neume, we would have no means of enforcing that agreement. Weighed down with apprehension, stung by what had been done to me, the last thing I felt like was watching Mazerian resume her interrogation of the prisoners, but Campion assured me it would take my mind off what had happened at breakfast. "I don't think so," I said sourly, but I went along anyway. The magistrate had told me to expect a flyer at 3, which left 5 hours, allowing for a margin of error. By the time Campion and I arrived, most of the room was already dialed up on synchromesh, the shatterlings sitting as stiffly and mutely as statues. All 4 cabinets were present, but only one of the occupants, the one on the right, was dialed down to a low stasis factor. Mazerian's voice tolled like a very low, ominously cracked bell. I let the drops settle into my eyes and then dialed up, not forgetting to set the expiration mechanism to bring me out in time for my meeting. Mazerian shifted into sudden, hectoring life. "We know exactly who you are," she said, strolling up and down the plinth in front of the cabinets. "What we don't know is why you've come back from the dead. Would you like to tell me what really happened, Thorn, when you were supposedly lost to attrition? Was your disappearance engineered so that you could attack other lines with impunity?"
"Go figure," said the man in the cabinet.
"Grilso was also lost to attrition. That suggests a pattern to me."
"Very attentive of you."
"I'm willing to bet the other 2 were also lost shatterlings. We'll identify their lines soon enough, Marceline, Melikton, or otherwise. In the meantime, you can help me with the House of Suns."
"You already asked me about that."
"And you told me that you know nothing, but I don't believe you. Is it a line, Thorn? One that the commonality doesn't know about?"
"There isn't any such thing."
"That we know of. But if such a thing existed, could it be kept secret?" Mazerian stroked her chin. "Possibly, if there was a good enough reason. But who'd benefit from the existence of a hidden line?"
"Call me when you find out."
"I think you know all about it. I think you may even be a part of it."
"You've already tied me to the Melictons."
"But you left them. What's to say you didn't join the House of Suns afterwards?"
"No one swaps between lines. That's not how it works."
"But the House of Suns is something else. It might operate according to entirely different rules. Feeding itself from the attrition of other lines, for instance. That's feasible. It could happen."
"Whatever you say."
"There'd need to be infiltration at line level, of course. Those shatterlings would need to fake their own deaths, which would mean elaborate planning. They'd have to know they were joining the House of Suns ahead of time, and they'd need to think it was better than staying inside their own line, with all the rewards and limitless possibilities that entails. Tough call, wouldn't you say? Being a shatterling is close to being a god. You'd need to offer someone the chance to become better than a god before they took that bait." There was a glimmer of wounded recognition in Thorn's eyes, a hint that Mazerian had put her finger on something raw. I shuddered to think of the devil's bargain he must have signed up to. Mazerian was right. We did have almost everything we could dream of. We had lived for millions of years, crossed the galaxy countless times over, drunk from the riches and glories of 10 million cultures. Matter and energy were our playthings. We could swaddle stars to stop them shining. We could flick worlds around as if they were specks of dirt. Entire civilizations owed their existence to our good deeds, unwitnessed and uncommemorated. We did marvelous, saintly things, and we never stopped to ask for thanks. What could be better than being a shatterling? Only one thing, I thought to myself. Being a wicked shatterling, being a devil instead of an angel, having all that power, all that wisdom, but being able to do anything with it, being able to destroy as well as create. "I was hoping you'd tell me everything you know about the House of Suns voluntarily," Mazerian said. It would have been easier that way, saved us all a lot of unpleasantness. But obviously that's not going to happen. I'm going to dial you out of stasis, back into real time. You may or may not survive the emergence. If you do, it will only be to face further interrogation. As soon as I get a living body, I'm going to section it. You know what that means, Thorn? Of course you do. You're a man of the world. You've seen some horrible, sickening things. We all have. Now you're going to become one of them, unless you talk.
I don't know anything about the House of Suns, he said, but there was something in his voice we had not heard before. He was frightened. The mask of defiance was beginning to crack. Mazerion reached for the handle. You're at 100 now. I'm taking you down to 10. She wrenched the lever to the left until it was resting at the penultimate notch. The cabinet made a groaning, decelerating noise, as of some huge turbine being suddenly braked. The cabinet quivered on the pedestal. The dials around the main lever tremored, registering savage, undamped time stresses. Mazerion adjusted her chronometer to match her subjective rate with Thorn's. Around the room, her hidden audience did likewise. I'm dialing back in a moment. This is your last chance to tell me what I want to know. Why did you ambush us? What is the House of Suns?
You won't do it, Thorn said. You need me alive too much. In here I can always tell you something, even if you can't force it out of me.
Why did you ambush us?
You had it coming.
What is the House of Suns?
Something you'll die never knowing about.
Mazerion twisted the dial on her chronometer, her movements accelerating from my perspective as the drug released her back into normal time. I reached for my own chronometer, but before I could do so, Mazerion's hand had flashed to the lever and slammed it all the way to the left. The cabinet flickered and emitted a sharp, coughing noise. I knew instantly that Thorn had died. A safe emergence would have been much less dramatic. The details of stasis technology have never been of interest to me. All I have ever pretended to understand is that the cabinet holds its occupant inside a bubble of space-time, separated from that which surrounds it by a microscopic membrane, like the white of an egg around the yolk. As the bubble approaches normal time flow, the interface between the bubble and external space-time should evaporate away into quantum indeterminacy. Most of the time, that is what happens. But once in a while, often with old or poorly designed caskets, the boundary behaves very differently. It adheres to the contents of the bubble, sticking like glue. In the same moment of failure, the interior of the bubble tears open and pushes outwards, compressing the contents against the unyielding barrier of that skin-tight membrane. We call it husking. That was what happened to Thorn. His shattered parts and the pieces of his throne rained onto the hard floor of the plinth. Mazerion knelt down and sorted through them until she found a piece of his face. It was like a clay imprint of an actor mimicking terror, clay that had been fired until it was glossy.
"You should have waited," said Charlock, rising from his seat. "He hadn't told us enough."
Mazerion sounded quite unfazed. "He told me everything he was ever going to. No amount of persuasion would have convinced him I was serious. The only way to do that was to take this chance."
"You lost one prisoner."
"There are three more. Now I can show them the empty cabinet and let them know I mean business." She lofted the piece of his flesh like a trophy. "And this. They'll recognize the face." Still holding the fragment, kicking her way through the rest of him, Mazerion walked to the second cabinet. Her hand moved to the stasis dial, ready to bring the prisoner within reach of Synchromesh. Part 4. One day, the little boy and his robot guards went up the ramp into his ship, and that was the last time I ever saw him the way he really was. I had no idea of that at the time. All I knew was that we had spent another afternoon in Palatial, another afternoon playing the long game of Empire. But it was not the last I saw of Count Mordax. I was 35 by the usual reckoning. By all objective measurements, I was still a girl of around 11 or 12 years of age, an unusually precocious girl, a girl with an adult's worth of memories, even if most of them consisted of life in the same house, but a girl all the same. But after 3.5 decades it was decreed by my guardians that it was time for my development to be allowed to proceed normally again. I was called into Madame Kleinfelder's office, and she asked me to roll up my sleeve. There was a small bump under the skin just below the crook of my elbow. Madame Kleinfelder touched a blunt stylus to the bump, and I felt a tingle, and that was the end of it. The bump was gone, and the biological machinery that had held me at a fixed age was no longer inside me. I felt no different, of course, but a clock that had been silent for years had just begun ticking. "Why now?" I asked. "When you were born," Madame Kleinfelder said, "it was never intended that you would be kept the way you have been. A modest degree of prolongation, yes. That's the norm nowadays, throughout the golden hour. Why race through childhood when you have a couple of 100 years ahead of you? But to be held at pre-puberty for 35 years, that is unusual even by modern standards." She put down the stylus and steepled her thick, wrinkled fingers, as she often did when delivering a lecture. "It was done at your mother's request, Abigail, back when she enjoyed extended periods of lucidity. The specialists convinced her that her madness could be cured, given time. They warned her that it might take a while, decades even. Your mother chose to hold you in a state of suspended development, so that she could still enjoy your childhood when she recovered. She could have had you frozen, of course, but this was her preferred method. She wanted to be able to look at you when she was lucid, to see you learning and playing. She did not want to look at a doll in a tank." Her fingers tensed around each other. "But your mother is not getting any better. If I have occasionally led you to think that the prognosis for recovery was better than it is, then I apologize. But nothing I did was done lightly. I was always thinking of you first, Abigail." "Then my mother won't be cured?" "They will keep trying, but her psychosis is now all-consuming. Every measure they have taken, and these are the best doctors in the golden hour, has resulted in an incremental worsening of her condition. The moments of lucidity have grown further and further apart. Perhaps they will stumble on a cure tomorrow, but we can no longer count on that. Which brings me to the difficult matter of the family business. Now that the likelihood of your mother recovering her faculties is so small, we must, with heavy hearts, look to the future." "To me," I said. I felt faint, as if I had stood up too suddenly. "This is no easy path you are about to walk, Abigail. You are going to grow up now. You are going to become a woman. And when the time is right, you are going to assume the mantle that your mother once wore. You will lead the family as she once did. Everything that she made, everything that she built, all the knowledge and cleverness she gathered, will be in your hands. It will be like an incredibly valuable ornament, a thing of fine colored glass and rare jewels. In your hands it will be safe, but you must never, ever drop it." When we were done, I went to my playroom and entered the room within a room that held the green cube of palatial. Although the developmental inhibitor had been removed, it was inconceivable that any measurable change had occurred within me. But I still felt as if the green cube, and the enchanted landscape it held, was something that belonged to my childhood. It was not that the game suddenly had no fascination for me. I could still feel its allure. But it would have been unseemly, inappropriate, even sordid, to step through the portal again. It may have been a month, or maybe a year later, I do not recall precisely, but there came a day when Madame Kleinfelder summoned me to her office. "There has been an important development, Abigail." My heart lifted. "My mother?" Embarrassment creased her face. "Not exactly. It's more to do with the family business. Although you have not been privy to the finer details, I do not think it is any great secret that we have been struggling since the armistice. The golden hour has little need of clones, not when there are machines clever enough to be our slaves instead. We've stayed afloat, but only because of a dwindling handful of loyal clients in the lesser worlds. Frankly, the omens have been inauspicious for several years, and with the continued expense of the works on the house, not to mention your mother's care, our reserves have been draining steadily away." She raised a finger before I had a chance to speak. "I'll be blunt. For many years, it was thought that our salvation might lie in the union of two trading concerns, the little boy you used to play with. It was hoped, by certain parties, that a marriage, a corporate alliance, might come from your friendship. By her tone, I was left in no doubt that those certain parties had never included Madame Kleinfelter. That won't happen now. They have gone with another combine, leaving us out in the cold. I am afraid you won't be seeing your friend again, Abigail. Not until you are old enough to make up your own mind about such things. At last I had been told the reason for the sudden curtailing of our adversarial, spite-laden friendship. I suppose I should not have mourned it greatly, but it was not as if I had 100 other friendships to turn to. I said nothing, for I sensed Madame Kleinfelter had more on her mind. But, as I said, there has been a development, and a potentially very fruitful one. Have you heard of a woman named Ludmilla Marcelin, Abigail?
I don't think so.
Generally speaking, that's to your credit. Ludmilla Marcelin is the heiress of one of the richest families in the Golden Hour. Unlike the Gentians, however, her familial wealth was not founded on any expertise in the natural arts. They simply made a lot of money by trading in financial instruments during the conflagration. Not that there isn't a skill there, but it's nothing compared with our knowledge of cloning, and cloning is very much the issue here.
I don't understand.
Ludmilla Marcelin has decided to embark on a project. It's an ambitious one, and it will make her many enemies. Not that that's ever stopped her. She's going to venture beyond the solar system and explore the known universe. Ever since the armistice, the Marcelin Combine has been gathering the wisdom and materials to make this happen. Now the final piece must be put in place, which is precisely where we come in. Ludmilla Marcelin needs Gentian wisdom. She needs clones.
Our clones.
Exactly, Abigail, and she's prepared to pay for our services. This is the lifeline we've been waiting for, a chance to set our finances on an even keel. Ludmilla Marcelin is a trend-setter. Where she leads, others will follow. But we must demonstrate our sincerity and commitment. The Board of Governors thinks it would be a good thing for you to meet with this woman, so that she can see for herself that the Gentians have a future. Will she come here?
No. We must go to her.
I have never left the house. There's a first time for everyone, Madame Kleinfelter said, before dismissing me. Not long afterwards, I was escorted to the shuttle pad and I left my house for the first time. As we pulled away from the planetoid, I saw the house for what it truly was, a kind of rampant architectural fungus spreading from horizon to horizon. It had not been the entirety of my world, for it had also contained the world within a world of palatial. But as it fell behind us, hazed in the wake of the shuttle's exhaust, I realized how pitifully small and limiting it had really been. The shuttle took me through the thick core of the Golden Hour, where the sky was dappled with the false stars and transient constellations of close-packed lesser worlds. By the time of my journey, I had read all I could about Ludmilla Marcelin, but even though the story cube was more forthcoming than it had been when I was younger, it still had nothing to say about her plans for exploring the universe. I kept thinking back to what the little boy had said to me during one of our visits, how one day humanity would burst forth from the Golden Hour into the wider galaxy. It had been his father speaking, but he had believed the words. I had countered by pointing out that there was nothing out there worth seeing, that probes and telescopes had told us all we could ever wish to know about the planets around other suns. Now I wondered what Ludmilla Marcelin knew that I did not. Before my audience with the heiress herself, I was taken to see her shipyard. The shuttle passed through a Marcelin security cordon into the private airspace around a large spherical asteroid. Gathered around the asteroid were dozens of huge, ugly-looking ships, each of which was larger than anything I had ever read or heard about. There were traceries of construction scaffolding around some of the ships, the occasional flicker of a welding torch or laser, a handful of space-suited workers, but to my untrained eye there did not appear to be much more to do. I counted 35 ships, then noticed a 36th slowly emerging from the asteroid. The rock had been lanced through the middle, like an apple on a spit. With our shuttle under remote control,
We passed into the opening. We came very close to the emerging ship, its hull sliding by only meters from the shuttle's windows. It was the same as the ones outside, except that the flower-like intake on the front had not been folded open. There would not be room until the spike-nosed craft had cleared the asteroid. The ships, I was informed, were ram scoops, vessels of a type that had been dreamed up 1,000 years earlier, but never built until now. The only previous interstellar expedition had reached a mere fifth of the speed of light, but these ships would go much faster than that. By the time they stopped accelerating, when the friction from their intake fields equaled the thrust that was being generated, the ram scoops would be traveling at 8/10 of the speed of light. They would be able to make round-trip journeys to the nearest stars while only a decade or so passed back home. But that was not what Ludmilla Marcelin had in mind. She was going to go much further out than that. She had no intention of returning to the golden hour. We passed into the core of the construction asteroid. It was being eaten from the inside out. A spherical cavity had been excavated in the middle, slowly widening as material was gouged away and transformed into ships. The hulls of partly formed vessels, some of which were close to being finished, while others were little more than skeletons, formed a forest of spikes pointing inwards. There were hundreds of them, but there would be hundreds more by the time Ludmilla Marcelin was done. The asteroid would be nearly depleted, little remaining except a gauzy husk, like the papery corpse left behind when a spider has digested an insect. In the middle of the open sphere was a free-floating station, to which a dozen or so shuttles and runabouts were already docked. We joined them and disembarked, and were met by Marcelin representatives. We were given food and drink, shown presentations and models, and made to feel suitably important. A great many adults made a point of talking to me, most of them struggling to tread a path between condescension and plain speaking. They all knew I was 35 years old, but it was difficult for them to remember that when dealing with someone who looked and sounded like a 12-year-old. Slowly, however, I got the gist of what Ludmilla Marcelin was intending to do. There would be 1,000 ships when she was finished. They would be launched into interstellar space on separate trajectories, each with a different solar system as its first objective. Some of the ships would have to fly only 12 light-years before arriving at their first port of call. Others would travel for 20 or 30, or even further. And each and every ship would carry Ludmilla Marcelin. Or rather, each and every ship would carry a duplicate of Ludmilla Marcelin, a clone, with the same personality and memories as the real woman. She was going to shatter herself into 1,000 facets and scatter them into interstellar space. Eventually she made an appearance, arriving on a shuttle from an inspection visit to one of the new ships. She was tall and glamorous, with a charisma that lit up the room as if she was the only source of light. She had a deep, commanding voice. It gave one the utmost confidence that she would follow through with her plans, no matter how outlandish they appeared.
"I have faith in the human spirit," Ludmilla Marcelin said. "Faith that says we won't stay here forever, in this little campfire huddle around an undistinguished yellow star. We've been in space for 1,000 years, long enough that the golden hour has been in existence for much longer than any living human. It's easy to think that it will last forever, that this stable arrangement will suffice for our needs until the sun peters out. It won't. Against the future that lies ahead of us, this 1,000 years will be just a moment, a drawing of breath, before the beginning of the real adventure. I have faith that the adventure is about to begin. I also intend to be one of the first participants. Soon I will have my ships, my fleet of 1,000 beautiful ram scoops. The clones that I will make of myself, the shatterlings, if you will each ride one of those vessels. The ships will take care of them. There need be no crews beyond a single copy of myself. My clones will be frozen until they reach their initial destinations, whereupon they will be thawed. They will make observations. They will leave their ships and travel down to new worlds and moons. They will look on things that no other human being has ever seen. When they have seen enough, they will continue their journeys. Each ship will make 3 predetermined ports of call, heading further and further out into the galaxy. After the third, the shatterlings will be entering territory for which we now lack hard data, visiting systems where the worlds are too far away to be resolved by our telescopes,
and which are beyond the range of our robot probes. The Shatterlings will have to make their own minds up about where to travel next, factoring in the knowledge they will already have gained since leaving the Golden Hour. Then they will lay in new courses and push further out. By this time, they will have been gone from the Golden Hour for more than a century. Many of you will be dead and buried, but I will just be getting into my stride. The Shatterlings will visit more stars, taste the air and soil of worlds that have never known a single strand of human DNA. They will swim in alien seas, adding to their store of memories. And then, 400 or 500 years from this day, somewhere around the middle of the present millennium, they will turn their great ships around and set course for home. Ludmilla Marcelin paused. She regarded us all with a forbidding demeanour before continuing, "But that home will not be ours. The Golden Hour may still exist in 500 or 1,000 years, but I'm not counting on that. My Shatterlings will convene in another system, around a world for which, as yet, we have no name. It is my conviction that by this time, humanity will have begun a migration into interstellar space. Perhaps my example will even spur it into action. On the long leg of their return journey, my 1,000 ships, or however many remain by then, will revisit some of the worlds they explored out the outward leg. They may find that those worlds have been settled since they left. If that is the case, then they will be strange visitors indeed, fugitives from the past, envoys to the future. Because even then I will only just be beginning. After this circuit of a few 100 light-years, 1,000 human years, my Shatterlings will convene again. They will meet and exchange memories of what they have experienced, and then they will get back into their ships and head out again. This time they will surf ahead of the expansion wave, not stopping until they are 100s of light-years out. They will visit more worlds. At the limit of their circuit, longer, this time, they will be nearly 1,000 lights from the Golden Hour. By then, they will be in range of some of the anomalous structures we have begun to detect in deep interstellar space. My Shatterlings will be the first people to reach out and touch those dark forms. They will be the first to know for certain whether others came before us, whether we are the first species to claim the galaxy as our own, or not. Or perhaps other people will get there first, riding similar ships. I am talking about 1,000 years from now, after all. But you see my point. Someone must take this first step. It might as well be me. How many circuits? Someone asked. She shrugged as if the question had never really occurred to her. As many as it takes, until it stops being fun. Each will be larger than the last, until my ships are looping around the Milky Way. By then, there will have been time for humanity to spread to every inhabitable system in the galaxy. I don't think it can fail to be an interesting place to be a tourist. Why not stay a while and see what happens? Ludmilla Marcelin answered our questions one at a time, demolishing every objection or quibble anyone had the brazen temerity to raise. The technology for freezing and thawing clones, no one had frozen and revived a human being since the dawn of the space age. No matter, a crash course in technology resurrection would give the Marcelins the tools they needed. The ships would not have to wait until it was perfected. They could leave with the clones still awake and beam the necessary science out to them once they were underway. The technology for merging memories from 1,000 individual experiences, a question beneath contempt, it was already there in embryonic form. I only had to think of the way Palatial had meddled with my own memories to know she was right about that. In 1,000 years, it would not even be worth remembering it as a problem. With similar inevitability, her Shatterlings could expect to gain the tools to manage those combined memories across massively extended lifespans. Ludmilla Marcelin was not going to go to all this trouble and have her clones die of senescence after only 2 or 3 circuits. The human race might be content with its current life expectancy, but nothing less than physical immortality would do for Shatterlings. They must be able to live for 1,000s of years, or at least be able to have their memories and personalities transplanted intact into new receptacle bodies, or the whole enterprise would be for nothing. But all of this was surmountable. Given time and money, there were very few problems in the universe that could not be solved. Which was when I thought of a question, one that harkened back to a long-ago conversation with the little boy. Why not go faster?
I don't think I follow you, Abigail, Ludmilla Marcelin said. She spoke to me nicely, for we had already been introduced. I mean, why settle for 8/10 of something that is already very slow?
Each time we meet, our ships will be improved using locally acquired science. Within a few circuits, I don't doubt that we'll have moved beyond these ram scoops to something capable of taking us much closer to light. That will bring benefits, of course. If the subjective time interval can be reduced, we won't need to spend so much time in deep freeze. But we'll always need some form of suspended animation. If our ships aren't to crush us alive, there'll be limits on how hard they can accelerate, which will mean they won't be able to reach arbitrarily high speeds before needing to slow down again. The point is that we want to go places. We don't want to just point our ships at the edge of the universe and keep accelerating all the way there.
I don't mean that. You're still talking about being limited by the speed of light.
It's not called a fundamental constant for nothing, Abigail. All the same, perhaps you're right. Perhaps some emergent civilization, some distant human splinter of the golden hour, will develop the tools for faster-than-light travel. If it happens, it will clearly be of significance to us. We'll embrace it wholeheartedly, have no fear. But it won't change the nature of what we are, or the reason for our existence. The galaxy will still be too big, too complex, for any one person to apprehend. Shattering, turning yourself into multiple points of view, will still be the only way to eat that cake. I have to say, though, that I don't consider the development of faster-than-light travel to lie within our future. Well-intentioned people have been chipping at that edifice for 1,000 years, Abigail. They've never found a way to move a single useful bit of information superluminally, let alone anything as huge and unwieldy as a ship. The limit is hardwired into the fundamental operating rules of the universe. It's like trying to play Go on a chessboard. Can't be done.
Why not?
Open your story cube on the way home and ask it to tell you about causality violation. I did once, because I asked the same question you did. Why should I be limited? What right does the universe have to say what I can and can't do? I'm intelligent. The universe is just a lot of hydrogen and dirt, going through the motions. But in this instance, the universe has the final say. Read the cube. I think you'll find it very illuminating.
There was more to see, more to learn. But the rest of our visit to the shipyard passed in a blur. I shook hands with Ludmilla Marcelin and expressed my commitment to providing her with the cloning technology that would make her vision a reality. All the while, my guardians, Madame Kleinfelter and the members of the Board of Governors, looked on with indulgent smiles, as if I had just sung a song on stage. The funny thing was, none of them could have had any idea what I was thinking. An idea had formed in my head. It could have been a small, wavering flame that scattered out almost as soon as it had ignited, but instead the flame only burned more brightly, more strongly, as time went by. Ludmilla Marcelin was going to scrawl her name across the sky. She was going to take giant steps across history, space, and time. It was awesome and frightening, too much for one person to imagine, let alone bring into being. But she was going to do it anyway. And the thought that was burning in my head was this. If she can do it, why can't I? As the family shuttle sped us home, 2 things of note happened. I said to Madame Kleinfelter, they're going to pay us a lot of money for our expertise, aren't they? Let's just say the house will have no cause to worry for quite some time, and that's not even assuming that others will follow where Ludmilla has led. But they will, mark my words. Even if she took those 1,000 ships and crashed them into the sun, she would have her imitators, and each and every one of them will need Gentian science to complete the shattering.
Then we are in a powerful position.
For the first time in a while, yes. Have the terms of the Marcelin deal been finalized? She gave me a peculiar look, as if I had uttered the most shaming of profanities. There are still details to be worked out, but the key elements of the arrangement...
We must have their ships, I said.
The ships are for Ludmilla Marcelin. Once she has made enough for her fleet, she will stop production.
I don't mean the ships themselves, but the blueprints to make them. We can find a metal asteroid if we look hard enough. If we can't, we can always tear apart the one under the house. But we must have the plans, so that we can make our own fleet.
Still not quite getting my point,
Madame Kleinfelter said, "But we don't need a fleet."
"I do," I told her. "I want what she has."
With Ludmilla's words still echoing in my head, I had the story cube tell me something about causality. At first, all the cube would give me was a babyish definition of what the word meant, not how it related to Ludmilla's plans for cosmic expansion. When I pushed the cube to explain to me how causality might be violated, I was rebuffed and discouraged, the cube deciding that it was a matter beyond my present conceptual horizon. I persisted. I could be very persistent. Faster than light travel, the cube eventually informed me, was problematic from a number of standpoints. From a mass energy perspective, light was like a mountain summit that was always out of reach, no matter how high you climbed. A ship could expend an insane amount of energy and come within 1 or 2% of that ultimate speed limit. But it would cost infinitely more energy to close that final gap, and even then the ship would only be traveling at the speed of light, not above it. In describing the properties of faster-than-light travel, the mathematics deliquesced into the Alice in Wonderland nonsense of imaginary numbers. Even then it could not tell you how to cross from one side of that barrier to the other. But even supposing that barrier did not need to be crossed, and that there was an effective shortcut through space-time, something like a wormhole, there was a deeper, subtler objection. It was called the causal ordering postulate. The postulate said that cause must always precede effect. It also said that the introduction into the universe of faster-than-light travel, the creation of what the cube called space-like causal connections, would lead to situations in which the causal ordering postulate might be violated. This was not just some theoretical nicety, but the opening of a door that would allow paradoxes to leak into reality. With faster-than-light travel, I could witness the consequences of an event, say, a hole appearing in a robot's armor because someone had shot a superluminal bullet at it, and send a superluminal message instructing the shooter not to fire. As lucid as the storybook's grudging illumination had been, I do not pretend that I understood all of this at the time, but I did grasp that the universe did not appear to be convivial to human dreams of effortless expansion. It said that we could have as much of the universe as we wished, but that the taking of it would demand an extraordinary kind of patience. I brooded on this for the rest of the night, feeling hemmed in and tight-chested, as if my restraints had been drawn too tight. The odd thousand-year-old cathedral aside, patience was not something humans had been very good at, collectively. Later, when the household's planetoid was at last in view, I received a call from a distant well-wisher. Madame Kleinfelter, still grey-faced after our earlier conversation, it was as if I had slapped her across the cheeks, took a dim view of his attempt to contact me. "It's not right," she said as my head was still ringing with causality. "They ruined any chance of a marriage, not us. What right does he have to taunt you now?"
"Maybe he doesn't want to taunt me. May I speak to him in private?"
I took the call. Time lag must have stilted our conversation, dragged it across many minutes, but I remember none of that. "I hear you did well with the Marcelins," the little boy said. He looked older now, as if he too had been allowed to start aging again. There was a roughness in his voice I did not recall from our afternoons in the playroom. "I'm happy for you. Sooner or later someone was going to require cloning expertise, and I'm sure this has not come a moment too soon."
"I didn't think I'd hear from you again."
"It would be improper for us to meet now."
"I'm sorry, Abigail. Really, I am."
"Nothing that happened at the Combine level had anything to do with me, or you, I imagine. We were just pawns being moved around at the whim of adults. All I'm saying is, I'd have liked it if we could have stayed friends."
"We can't."
"You say that as if you're the one deciding things now. Have you really stepped into your mother's shoes?"
"It's none of your business."
"For what it's worth, I'm sorry for the way I talked about her to you. That wasn't nice of me at all. But I suppose you had to know eventually. There was always something a bit lopsided in our relationship, with me knowing far more about you than you ever did."
"Don't lose any sleep over it."
"Oh, I shan't. Had the roles been reversed, I have no doubt that you'd have been just as cruel as I was. But there is unfinished business between us, wouldn't you say?"
My head was still spinning with fantasies of interstellar conquest, of shattering myself into 1,000 gem-like shards and imbuing each of them with the vital spark of my own personality. The little boy was a knock on the door from a past I no longer cared about. I wanted him to go away and take my childhood with him. "I don't think we have unfinished business." "We never completed Palatial," he said. It was ages since I had given that green cube more than a moment's thought. The world inside it was frozen in the configuration it had held when we last emerged from the portal. "That's over now."
"It doesn't have to be. I can't visit you, obviously, but there's another solution. One of the copies of Palatial, one of the prototypes, happens to have fallen into my possession."
"We still can't meet."
"We don't have to. The games can be synchronized. I can go into my version of Palatial and share the same narrative space as yours. I'll be in the Black Castle and you'll be in the Palace of Clouds, but they'll both be part of the same landscape. If I send out a messenger, he'll show up at your gates. Send an army to me and I'll meet them with my own forces. It was always meant to work this way, Abigail. It's how they designed it. There'll be time lag, of course, but that won't matter unless we end up having a face-to-face conversation. Everything else takes hours in Palatial anyway. It's called being pre-industrial."
"We can't do this."
"We must. I didn't go to all the trouble of finding another copy for nothing. I was always thinking of you, of the game we still had to finish."
"They won't allow it."
"Then make them allow it. You have the authority now, Abigail, or you soon will. Use some of it. Throw your weight around. Demand the right to connect your version of Palatial with mine."
He leaned back from the camera. "Count Mordax will be waiting. Please don't let him down."
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.